Time to check in with Docs Threatened Species Ambassador. She is Nicola Tookey and she joins us weekly for Critter of the Week. Hello there.
Good afternoon.
Just reiterating for people who didn't catch us last week, we're running a little competition, Nicola and I. It's called Knit a Critter. We ask you to knit your favourite native species, either in the form of a soft toy or like a picture on a jersey or however you want to interpret that theme. And we're going to donate it all to the Maungaree Refugee Resettlement Centre, thanks to the Red Cross, and you win a prize if it's your favourite one, but nothing will go to waste. It's been very exciting, and I've heard such amazing feedback this week from people who are not only knitting themselves or crocheting themselves, but spreading the word among their knitting groups.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So there's been lots of excitement at work. In fact, as we were talking last week, I got immediately got an email from the Director General of DOC, who was driving back from Operation Tidy Fox. He'd been down there picking up rubbish.
Yeah.
Lou, and he said, "Not a critter, great." And then he said, "I think my mum might enter." So
go Lou's
he's
mum.
Very excited. Good on you. Go Lou's mum. Hopefully she does. And one of our botanists did admit that she probably won't qualify because she's DOC, but she wanted to, she's very obsessed about all the amazing little dryland plants of the Mackenzie Basin in particular. And she really, really wants to, she's very good at crochet, and so she wants to crochet a fish guts plant, which we've actually talked about on Critter.
That's the best. I love it so much. okay, so I'll send people to the website if they want to find out more. rnz.co.nz/Jessie. I think I worked out you've got about 10 weeks to do it, so plenty of time to knit your critter, but we're expecting them to start flooding in at any time. We also, there's a free post too, so you can send your piece of knitting in. However, the other piece of correspondence I've received this week comes from a Miss Irene Coleman. This came to our Critter of the Week mailbag, which I've just invented. It says, "Dear Jessie and Nicola, can Nicola please help with this question? It's regarding introduced predators like stoats. What is the instinct or impulse that makes a stoat on the edge of the mainland jump in the water and start swimming? How do they know that they'll find land, especially land with a food supply? Are they able to smell or hear prey?" Anyway, that's actually three questions, but it's something that's puzzled me. And clearly, whatever it is, it's working for the stoat. Thanks, Irene.
So I love this question from Irene, and I've been researching it. I'm not sure I can entirely give you the answer to your three questions, but I can give you a starter for 10. So apart from the fact that, you know, stoats are basically the Kurt Russell of the wildlife world.
What?
Pretty tough. Well, you know.
Kurt Russell?
Well, you know, is it Kurt Russell? Who? No, who's the one who's really good at
it? It was Kurt Russell about 30 years ago.
Okay, well, someone tough. Let's say they're the Dwayne
Try
Johnson.
Dwayne the Rock Johnson. Kurt Russell. Yeah, he's okay. About 70, Nicola.
they're the Rock of the wildlife world. In fact, wouldn't
the
they
Vin
go
Diesel.
Well in that in that show that he's got at the moment? That was basically like modern day gladiators. And so, you know, we know, for example, that stoats. We generally understand that stoats can swim up to about 2 kilometres. I mean, they can certainly swim 1.5 kilometres, which is why, you know, in the Department of Conservation, all our little predator-free offshore island lifeboats, they're pretty limited because they have to be more than 2 kilometres away from shore.
Uh-huh.
And then every now and then we find things like we found a stoat on Rangitoto Island in 2010 that was 3 kilometres offshore. And then one on Kapiti Island the following year, which is 5 kilometres offshore.
Oh,
and I don't
gosh.
Know if you've ever taken the boat ride out to Kapiti, but it can be rough as guts through the strait there between Kapiti Island and the Kapiti Coast. So they are pretty unbelievably tough.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether there are a couple of things going on. Now, we may not know what they can smell or not smell, but what we do know about populations is when there are limited resources and quite a high population of a particular species, particularly predators, they're constantly on the search for prey.
Mm.
And if you're a stoat, that's, you know, your whole body system is just moving at this, you know, this sort of million miles an hour, it probably isn't that big a deal to kind of look out to see and be like, I could go out there. And so I could take that.
Yeah.
So the person who knows the most about stoats in New Zealand is Professor Carolyn or Kim King at the Faculty of Science in Waikato. And about five or six years ago, she got 10 stoats and put them in a tank. You know when your dog gets really sore legs and you take it to aquatherapy and they have a little tank
yeah.
with a current and you get your dog to sort of swim along. So she flew these stoats to Hamilton and put them in a water-filled flume, which had a continuous current in it, and just watched them go. And she had one female who covered 1.8 kilometres in nearly 2 hours non-stop, which I thought was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Three other stoats swam really strongly for more than an hour, and another four chalked up between 20 and 40 minutes of paddling. So I suspect it depends on the stoat and the tenacity and the sort of determination, because they obviously all have different personalities. One of them, for example, after about 10 minutes had the stoat equivalent of a panic attack and they had to pull it out because it was just not coping.
Yeah. I must admit, even as a bird lover, I find the idea of 10 stoats like swimming until they run out of energy a little bit macabre, but I'm sure they didn't just like let them drift to the bottom of the tank.
No, they fished them out and towered them down and probably gave them a treat and put them back in their enclosure. It wasn't, you know, it's not the 1950s. What we do, so we don't necessarily know what makes them go, other than, I imagine, you know, resource pressure and just bloody-mindedness and, you know, guts. Because stoats, you know, every time I've encountered a stoat in the wild, it's looked at me like, I'll take you on. And they're only about, they're not much bigger than, the, you know, a 2B pencil. So
yeah,
they really have an
If anyone's listening who might be able to offer further information to fill this picture out for us, do get in touch. We have all sorts of conservationists and botanists and, well, not botanists, what am I looking for, like, you know, critter experts listening. And we may just have one listening who'd done a master's on how a stoat finds its food. Who knows? Get in touch with us. Now, I guess one good thing about being a moth, Nicola, is you don't really have to worry about rats and stoats too much. I don't imagine that predation is a big issue for them so much as habitat loss.
No, I imagine a stoat or a rat might take on a moth. I had an uncle once who used to do it for party tricks.
What was his name?
Uncle Roy.
Uncle Roy, that's perfect. Roy, the moth-eating uncle. Goodness me.
Yeah, it was a great trick outside, you know, the outside light of community halls.
Yeah.
I tried it myself and it ended in vomiting, so he must have a stomach.
Well, when I was flatting, we had a big security light and I was out there having a smoke with my flatmate Hamish once and a moth flew into his ear. That was a stressful night for him.
Well, if this particular moth we're talking about today flew into your ear, you'd certainly know about it because it's at least 6 centimetres across. So it probably wouldn't be very pleasant. So today we've got a wonderful critter for everyone. We're going to have today the discussion of the tale of the frosted phoenix, which is a kind of moth that is so secretive, much like the Order of the Phoenix in Harry Potter, if you like, that it has not been seen since 1959.
In case people didn't catch that when you said it first, Frosted Phoenix is the name of the Critter of the Week moth, Titanomus cicerota.
Correct. And Titanomus basically means giant, anomalous giant.
Uh-huh.
So it's because it's quite a big moth, and it's very unusual in terms of how it looks. And so we're not quite sure who it belongs to. We don't quite know what family it comes from. And the idea of it being the frosted phoenix it has this wonderful kind of white frosting on the bottom of its forewings. And Robert Hoare at Landcare just gave it this name, this common name, because, of course, the phoenix is the bird thing that rises from the ashes of it. You know, it lives for 500 years and then it burns to ashes and then it rises from the ashes again. And it's kind of a great description of the story of the Frosted Phoenix because, you know, before 1959, the last one that had been found was 1921. In fact, there's only been 10 specimens of the Frosted Phoenix ever found in New Zealand.
Well, are we confident that this thing is still alive?
Well, we can't say beyond the shadow of a doubt that it is still around. But from an entomologist point of view, particularly a lepidopterist, someone who studies moths and butterflies, it's kind of okay to have that difference in time span between locating them. And there's quite a bit of quite a few clues about the way that this moth appears, which might suggest that it might be a wetland type moth. And you know, there's not many of us that go traipsing around inside wetlands. Mm. But, you know, people don't get as kind of jazzed up about moths as they do about butterflies. You know, the butterfly is kind of the dolphin of the moth world, isn't it? But moths are, and butterflies form about 150,000 species on Earth. So they're pretty omnipresent. Mm. And we know that we've got about 1,700 of them in New Zealand. Half of those are micro moths. Just not about the giant frosted phoenix right now, but half of all species of moths in New Zealand have a wingspan of less than 2 centimetres.
Uh-huh.
Who knew?
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the frosted phoenix. As I said, it's only been found 10 times. There's only 10 specimens of it that have ever existed in New Zealand, and only one of those is a male. And there's some evidence to suggest that might be because if it is a wetland species, the males will tend to stick around in that habitat, whereas the females kind of search further around for food. Mm. And twice people have found it in their living rooms when it's been attracted to the light.
Well, actually, in their drawing rooms.
Yes.
Which is what they called them back in the middle of the 20th century. And it struck me that I'd be quite interested to hear if anyone listening still calls a room in their house the drawing room, or is that just like an anachronism?
Yeah, I suspect it might be. Mm. I was singing a song the other day, which a Flamin' Pretty song, which refers to the word, it talks about I found it in the parlour, and somebody queried me on it and said that's the lounge.
Yeah. The parlour and the drawing room are different worlds. Okay, Nicola, we are a little pressed for time, so what would you like to finally tell us about this before you rate it?
One thing I would tell you about it is thank goodness there are passionate entomologists out there. Thank goodness for Robert Hoare, who gave it that fascinating name and allowed us to make Harry Potter references to it. Hmm. But one thing we need in New Zealand are more people who are out there looking for moths.
Yeah.
and wanting, you know, if we could find another specimen of this could unlock the mystery of the frosted phoenix. And I would recommend you use iNaturalist. If you're out there and you're finding moths and you bang off a photo on your camera and just upload it to iNaturalist, some dedicated moth nerd will tell you within hours of what you've found, and find next greatest thing.
So good. That's the name of the app, iNaturalist. It's sort of related to Nature Watch, which is, the better known brand name. My daughter came in and she said, Daddy, can I borrow your phone to take a photo of something to put on a Nature Watch? And I was like, sure. You know, it's going to be a leaf or something. She came in with the most unusual things that she'd found on the deck, these creepy, grey, sludgy things. Anyway, we uploaded it, and today someone got in touch and they've identified it as parts of an earthworm regurgitated from a miner's stomach.
Oh, that is fantastic.
I know, amazing, eh? Amazing. So there are some very cool people on that app who can help you, and it's quite good because it records where you saw the thing as well, and you can get a bit of a map of frequency and proximity of the particular species you're photographing.
I think that every New Zealander's got Facebook and Twitter and whatnot on their phone. You should make it compulsory to have iNaturalist as well.
Yeah, well said. Could you please rate the attractiveness of the frosted phoenix moth on a scale of 1 to 10, Nicola?
I think it's beautiful. It looks like it's wearing a coat from the 1940s. It gets a 6 from me.
Yeah. Straight to the drawing room. Nicola Tookie, Doc's Threatened Species Ambassador. Thanks so much. Lovely to chat with you. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next Friday.
See you, Jessie.